almost hour, culture, current events, our Catholic faith, 15 minutes every afternoon here at Breadbox Media. Today, I promise to be an equal opportunity offender, if you will, because I know that there are those who think all I do is bash Trump. All I do is say how much I am not in favor of this candidate. So today, I'm going to talk a little bit about why I'm also not in favor of Hillary Clinton. So there should be a little bit of balance here in today's show. So we got that. Also, the abortion ruling yesterday, what this looks like as far as the states that have already done some things when it comes to this type of legislation, or at least tried to halt abortuaries from doing things that they were doing because of improper medical practices or not having things up to speed. Could be some serious fallout and a big step backwards in the pro-life arena. We'll talk about that. Also, Volkswagen with the emissions challenges, $14.7 billion settlement, and what that means. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. All of that and more this afternoon. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown Almost Hour. Back in a moment.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Our culture, current events, our Catholic faith, 50 minutes every afternoon. Thank you for joining us. Follow me over on Facebook, Leo C. Brown. You'll see the things that we talk about on the show posted over there for your posting enjoyment, your responding enjoyment. Yes. So lots of conversation the past couple of days over this. It hinged upon the Supreme Court ruling regarding the overturning of the abortion laws in Texas and basically saying the constitutional right to protect abortion overrides, apparently, safety, right? Medical safety. And that's what this is about. That's what I kind of was simply saying, look, let's raise the standards, at least of the abortuaries, to that of any outpatient facility. And by doing so, this apparently made it impossible for 80% or so of the abortion facilities in the state of Texas to operate. Should tell you something. But of course, what it ends up being is that, well, we got to protect abortion at all costs, which means let's overturn that, because we can do that kind of stuff because we have a Supreme Court. Now, this leads me to the next topic, which is voting with the Supreme Court in mind. And I've gotten a lot of flack about my position, because I think it's pretty clear, I've stated it very definitively, that I am no Donald Trump fan, and no, I will not be voting for him, nor will I be voting for Hillary Clinton. I, as a Catholic, place a high regard on moral integrity. Yes, I'm a sinner. Yes, I fall short. Yes, I do stupid things. But when it comes to something for me, which is pretty darn serious, my father, my father-in-law, my wife, my mother-in-law, just a few in my family who were members of the armed forces who have fought for our freedom, and certainly that right to vote is something I value. So I'm not going to throw it away. And don't think that by me finding the appropriate candidate who I believe in, even if no one's heard of them, is a throwaway vote. That's not. That is me voting with my conscience. That is me voting with an informed conscience, mind you. It's not me just thinking, okay, I'm going to do this because I think it's cool or I don't like Donald Trump's hair. No, it's because there's some real issues when it comes to the two main candidates and the four tenets. I talked about this on Facebook as well, of responsible Catholic voting, responsible citizenship, which we've discussed this yesterday, and I will keep repeating this because I think it's important. We need to understand that there are four areas that we have to get right. And those are dignity, human dignity, first and foremost. Again, including the right to life, of course, that is paramount. In addition to that, common good. We have to work for the common good. This means a pluralistic society. This means commonality among the number of plurals that are out there, whatever it happens to be, religious, ethnic, you name it, right? We've got to have common good. We've got to have subsidiarity. Subsidiarity says on the local level, we have to be able to make decisions. The most local of all levels, the family. We've got to protect the family, and that is vital in moral decision-making and responsible Catholic citizenship. And then finally, solidarity, which means we say all of us are in this together. We've got to reach across the aisles. We've got to knock down the silos. We've got to be bridge builders, not wall builders. This is what has to happen. Now, the quiz that I put on my Facebook page, Leo C. Brown, you can follow me over there, asked the question, what do these four tenets and our two leading candidates have in common? Which many got it right. Absolutely nothing. There's nothing. Nothing here. So what I have to do is make a decision to say I got to cast a vote for somebody else. And of course, the criticism I keep getting is, well, the Supreme Court is at stake, Leo, and you're throwing that vote away, and we got to vote for whomever, right, to protect that. Which, in my opinion, I believe this is flawed logic, because my vote is my vote, and the person who will get my vote has gotten my vote. They've gotten my vote. They've earned my vote. They've earned my vote by having moral integrity. They've earned my vote by being as close to the Catholic moral tenets, those four foundational points of responsible citizenship, and I'm going to cast my vote because of that. They've earned that. That is not a vote for someone else, and we do not know. We do not know the winner of this political contest until the votes are tallied on election night. So please don't fall for that. It's out there. It's rampant. Everybody wants to talk that game, and it's garbage. It's just frankly garbage, and we've got to realize that. Also, there's some interesting conversations we've been having on my Facebook page regarding the politicization of the court, which the Supreme Court was never designed to be a political body, meaning partisanship, right? Or even political, for that matter, in the sense that these are appointees. These are individuals who have to pass a muster of the congressional hearings, the congressional confirmation, to get to the point of what should be an assumption that they have at least enough balance to see both sides of an issue. They are a judge, right? They're a justice. They're a Supreme Court justice. They should have the integrity to be able to look at something from all sides, explore it in, most importantly, light of our Constitution, right? It's not about who's liberal, who's conservative, and why, honestly, why we want to stack the deck in our favor. To me, there's something almost weird about that. Call me crazy, but I think there's something weird about that, because we want to say, well, we want to get our side heard. It shouldn't be a matter of sides. The Supreme Court should be, let's choose a justice who is fair. Let's choose a justice that not only is fair, but is going to see everything in light of the constitutionality of that decision. Now, I've been disappointed. Been disappointed in Supreme Court decisions, there's no doubt. And I would question, personally, how sometimes there's even a threat of constitutionality in some of the decisions. I just don't get it. I don't see how they've pulled this together. But again, I'm not a judge. I've never been to law school. I don't understand things as well as these guys apparently. And so I just have to take it, right? I have to take it for what it is. But what I don't want is an imbalance of power, conservative or liberal. I don't even want those words being associated with the court. You know, and I've made the statement many times, look at what Ronald Reagan did. And I got a beef with Reagan on a number of things, quite frankly. No-fault divorce as governor of California. This was a domino, right? And the first state, I think it was 1968, correct me if I'm wrong, when, as governor of California, then Governor Ronald Reagan signed into law no-fault divorce, which became law of the land. You want to talk about a landmark decision that has had more detrimental effect on the family than I believe anything out there was then the allowance for someone to walk away without any repercussions from their marriage. Thank you, Ronald Reagan, giving that to the country. The great, the almighty, the omniscient Ronald Reagan, right, who did this. So realize who we're talking about here. But nonetheless, he did appoint Anthony Kennedy. He did appoint Kennedy. And Kennedy has been that swing voter. He has been the guy who has, certainly in this recent case, made the decision for the majority, along with the majority, to strike down this law, to strike down the legislation in Texas. He was there in Obergefell. I don't even know how to say this. Obergefell. The same-sex marriage case, we know, you know what I'm talking about, hopefully. And he was a Reagan appointee. So don't tell me that it's all about the Supreme Court. Don't tell me that. You can't. There's no evidence to suggest that that's the case. And again, even if we were voting just to stack the court, is that what we want to do? And the one challenge I've put out there, which I have yet to see a response to, is this. Show me where in the document from the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops instructing the faithful, us Catholics in the pews, on how to be responsible citizens and how to form our consciences properly, tell me where it talks about stacking the deck for the Supreme Court or voting for the lesser of two evils or making sure, hey, you know, vote against that if you have to vote for somebody you don't want, as long as the individual you don't want, you really don't want, is in there. If you vote for the other guy that you kind of don't want, then that's the way to morally do this. That language is not there. Please understand. There's no instruction for voting in this fashion. No, it's vote with a well-formed conscience, that conscience which is formed by Catholic teaching, and the four tenets, not non-negotiables, mind you, but the four tenets of responsible citizenship being dignity of the human person, the solidarity, subsidiarity, and the common good. Those are the four. Out of time. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown Almost Hour. Back after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Our culture, current events, our Catholic faith. 50 minutes every afternoon exclusively here on Breadbox Media. You can be a friend of the show. You can be a friend of this show or any show. And that is going to help us do what we do here. It's also going to provide a little bit of extra love and the added content that you get, the exclusive content that's a part of what we do here at Breadbox Media. You can find out more about the Friend of the Show by clicking the Friend of the Show link on our website or on the sidebar menu on the app. So if you're on the app, you go to the sidebar menu, you can find it all over there. So by all means, check it out. We want you to be a friend of the show. So, interesting news for Volkswagen, $14.7 billion. Sometimes it just doesn't connect, right? I know what I'm thinking. Doesn't come out that way. Volkswagen agreeing to pay $14.7 billion to settle the emissions claims. Now, that's a big chunk of change. I'm guessing a painful chunk of change, even for a company the size of Volkswagen. It would have to be. You get into multi-billions, that's got to be a difficult pill to swallow. But certainly what you would hope is that this precedent that's set, because, yes, it's about emissions, and it's about auto manufacturing, but I think bigger than that, it's about bearing false witness, right? It's about putting out something there that is completely and blatantly as untrue as the day is long, and the fact that you got to know it. You got to know that you're doing this. So my hope is, and whether this actually sinks in, we take this to heart, the rest of us, people in business, take it to heart. When it comes to deceiving, the public, there's a hefty price to pay. And I would hope that we wouldn't do anything of this nature, but I think there's such temptation at times when we kind of think, well, you know, nobody really has to see that. Nobody has to know. And that one little ethic of such can lead down a road that, you know, there are slippery slopes. You know, that's a common argument that, well, if we do this, the ultimate end will be, and you can't necessarily do that when you're debating a topic or trying to take something to its logical end. You just really can't intellectually, with any kind of honesty, always draw those conclusions that everything is a slippery slope. But I tell you what is, and that is deception. When we begin to deceive, we begin to deaden our conscience, right? And that's what this is really about. It's about the bigger lesson of what does it mean? What does it mean when we allow ourselves to deceive on that level? It's probably going to mean that we get some integrity issues that will continue to potentially escalate, snowball. And I think that that's kind of what happened here, obviously, to the point that now a $14.7 billion settlement, which has to be painful. And, you know, that's kind of what it comes around to, is that there's always a price to pay. And Scripture is pretty clear about our sins finding themselves out. Be sure your sins will find them out. That's something that we should bear in mind. But again, we get to this point of just a deadened conscience, and the next thing you know, we're taking all kinds of unnatural, antithetical steps. And I think that probably for the vast majority of Catholics, the biggest area, quite honestly, is integrity of sexuality. And, you know, we just had this, which, by the way, I think it's interesting. I posted this on my Facebook page, the response from homosexual activists regarding this announcement from Pope Francis, basically saying that we need to apologize to the gay community, to those that have been offended by unfair practices, cultural practices, hiring practices, you name it, whatever, those who have been singled out. And it's been applauded, but then, well, those who say, well, it hasn't gone far enough, because until the church recognizes marriages between same-sex couples, well, then we'll never be satisfied. Rather than just going, hey, Pope Francis, thank you for the nod, thank you, which would be the gracious way to accept this, right? You don't just look at this and then go, oh, yeah, still not good enough. Yeah, I mean, come on, what are you trying to prove with that? But I will say this, I am impressed with Relevant Magazine, our evangelical brothers and sisters who do Relevant. Always interesting stuff, and I was very impressed with their handling of what Pope Francis had to say, and really kind of bringing it down to a commonality there of saying, look, you know, we embrace this same dynamic, and I think it's pretty cool to see that those guys would accept this, and even the comments, very positive, some kind of asking some good questions, but at the same time, I think really kind of hitting the nail on the head the way they should. So hats off to Relevant. Thank you so much. And that's posted over at my Facebook page as well. But back to this slippery slope of integrity. And I think that certainly I know that the stats are out there to say that Catholics contracept right along with the rest of the culture at about 98%. Some Catholics have even stepped into the full-blown contraception mentality of sterilization. And then, and not that I know this, I'm not saying that there are those who do this and do that, because I don't know for a fact, but I have to assume, based on statistics, that there would be those who are contracepting. And certainly, this is culturally, right? So I'm not going to couch this only in the Catholic subset, but I'm going to say across the culture, if it's true that there's 98% of the general populace who are of childbearing age, which is a pretty wide range, and they are contracepting, some are completely sterilized, and then you have the discrimination against homosexuals coming from the culture, that stands to reason, okay, follow my logic, that stands to reason that there are some who in their heterosexual relationships are contracepting and at the same time being critical of homosexuality. Now, I know this because I came from it. I know this happens in the evangelical and Protestant world. I know that. I know that. I know that those two do connect, undoubtedly, which is unfortunate because we've talked about this a zillion times, but I still don't think it's understood that sexual sin is, that sexual sin is the same, right? The sin of contracepting, even among married couples, maybe even especially, I don't know if you can kind of qualify like that necessarily, but I mean, maybe if you're talking about sacramentality and the validity of marriages and the things that kind of go into that, maybe you could say there's greater moral weight in that world. I'm no moral theologian. I only play one on the radio, but I would guess that there has to be some sort of something that could say, boom, there's a little bit more expectation there, no doubt, because of the sacramental nature. But still, contraception, homosexuality, exactly the same. Exactly the same. From the standpoint of what the sin issue is. And the sin issue is simply, it's an undignified approach to the other, right? Because we are essentially objectifying the individual who is experiencing the sexual act as only a means to an end, because it's the unitive and procreative elements of the gift of human sexuality are voided. They're just voided, right? You can't truly have true unification without the potential of procreation, because the one flesh union that says these two shall become one is what the gift of sexuality is all about. And not that every sexual act has to result in conception, mind you, but there has to be an openness, because that openness is what creates the unitive, right? That's what brings this together into a newness of life that models Christ in the church. So pretty weighty stuff. And typically we're talking to Father Thomas Loya on Tuesday afternoon. So that's my little theology of the body time today. So for what it's worth, be back in just a moment. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, Almost Hour. Back after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Leo Brown, Almost Hour, Culture, Current Events, Our Catholic Faith, 50 minutes every afternoon. Follow me over on Facebook. You'll see the things we talk about here on the show. And I thought I posted this, then I went back and looked, and I couldn't find it, so I'm going to have to dig it out and post it again, because as I started the show, I want to have an equal opportunity here. I want to be balanced as much as I can. I know I bashed Trump a lot because I think of the Catholic support that I see, and maybe I'm wrong, but I just haven't seen that outpouring for Clinton from my fellow Catholics, and it could be out there. So anyway, to address the Clinton issues as equally as I can, Hillary's coming out basically saying that she's got some trust issues to deal with, that people just don't trust her. And I guess I'm happy to see the self-awareness there, right? Self-awareness, it's kind of a thing these days, right? To try to be as self-aware as we possibly can. So if she's coming out saying that, hey, I know I got some trust issues, then maybe there's hope. Maybe she has some self-awareness. Maybe there's some opportunity for her to kind of come around and go, what can I do with this? Who knows? Not voting for Clinton, not voting for Trump, just so you know. But interesting. Now, on the Trump side, this reaction, this lack of reaction to the Supreme Court decision yesterday is very interesting. And WorldNet Daily, I posted a story on my Facebook page that basically says, well, his response, he had a pre-response, I guess, and it was to the Christian leaders that he met with, and it was at that point where he made such a definitive promise to only appoint the staunchest conservative justices that's all they need. That's all anybody needs. He did it. He responded even before this decision, because he anticipated it, and so therefore he's saying, hey, this is going to happen under my watch. Those four seats that are available, I'm going to make sure that they get filled by the right kind of justices, which, excuse me, there are not four seats available, okay? I want us all to understand that right now. I don't care how old the justices are. There's one seat open. There's one seat available right now that needs to be filled, which the Senate has already said we're going to wait until the election to begin the proceedings, and this is where we are with one seat. Now you can say, well, we've got four other justices that are old enough that they may be retiring. And as I've said repeatedly on Facebook, Oliver Wendell Holmes, okay, was a Supreme Court justice who sat on the bench until he was 90 years old. in the 1930s. So we don't know. We don't know. So you cannot predict that. You can't say, well, the next president is going to potentially appoint 4 justices. Well, we don't know that. We don't know that. Maybe. It could be the case. But this is what I propose. I would say if you were a liberal and you were sitting on the bench and you had an ultra-conservative in the White House, you would hold on to that seat for dear life. You're not going to retire and leave that open for someone to fill that would potentially imbalance the court. Now, some have said, well, Mike even commented on this on Facebook. He said, Leo, I don't think the justices have such a politicized view of their positions on the bench. And Mike, I love Mike Allen, but I think it's just as political. My guess is it has to be just as political on the bench than from those of us who are on the outside looking at. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm jaded. I know that. I'm a cynic. But still at the same time, I have to wonder, would a justice let go of their seat so easily if they knew it was going to be filled by someone from a different ilk of ideology? I wouldn't, right? I wouldn't. If I had that option, I would hang in there. I don't care how tough it is to get to work. I'm going to hang in there and say, I'm going to hold on to this seat until I can trust that my seat is going to be filled by someone who has my ethics. Whether you agree with those ethics or not, I'm just saying, hypothetically speaking, doesn't that seem to make sense? Again, maybe I'm wrong, but that's how I see it. So don't tell me that the vote is all about the Supreme Court. I don't buy it. We could have 4 seats to fill, but we only know we have 1. That's what we know. So, for what it's worth. Interesting story when it comes to now this this Brexit, of course, with now markets in a tailspin. We'll see what kind of recovery time it's going to take to get this up and going. But there's obviously no market confidence in the Britain doing anything to bring its currency up anytime soon. So we'll see what happens with that. But, which, by the way, get a bunch of sterling, right? Get a bunch of British sterling, because this, once it does go up, you got the opportunity now. If you want to invest in something, there's your opportunity. But and by the way, that was Warren Buffett's deal, right? He, before the EU was formed, it was investing in British sterling that got this guy his bazillions of dollars. So it can work. It can definitely work. And all it's going to take is a handful of investors there, and that's going to bring their currency up. So I don't know why that hasn't already started. I would think it would if an investor was going to guide someone. Not that I know anything about that stuff. I don't want to pretend to know anything about it, but it doesn't stand to reason. Anyway, so now not only is it the UK who has broken away, now we got Scotland looking at a potential referendum, right? We talked about that. They're looking at this. But now London, the city of London, there are those who are saying it's time for Londoners to take back their whatever their not their country, but just their city, right? To have this movement of extreme localism, which is the only thing I can think of. And I think there's a lot of pride in communities. There should be. We all should have that kind of pride. But at the same time, while we should have subsidiarity, again, the local level being really the prime level for decision-making, that doesn't mean that we're just going to disconnect from everything. So it's interesting, right? We had city-states in the dawn of civilization. This was kind of there was such extreme tribalism. This is what it grew from, right? Being in this very close-knit, connected, territorial group that then began to form a larger economy. And as a result of that, this city-state concept. And I know that there are those. I know they exist. I know that there are those now, right now, in our own country, who would want to see, especially states, succeed. They would want to break away. There's something about this confederacy. There's something about this idea of having a very, doing your own thing. And the interesting thing is, there's, as we bring this all around to put a big wrapping bow on this package today, this Supreme Court ruling, Texas alone. There are some saying, who cares about the federal mandate? Who cares about the Supreme Court ruling? Just do your own thing, state, because that's what you can do. And don't tell me that there aren't plenty of Texans who would want their independence. I'm sure. And it's not just Texas. There are many states with intense loyalty to their communities and to that state. And again, it's a desire for subsidiarity. I doubt they even know what that means. I'm not saying that to disparage anyone. Don't think I'm saying that. It's such a Catholic thing, right? It's such a insular to us as Catholics. It's almost something that we own that no one else has, the few understand. But it really comes down to that localism and getting things done on the local level. I've used this example many times, but Nashville, Tennessee, what an amazing example of subsidiarity when they had the flood several years ago, and this was pretty close on the heels of the Katrina disaster. We didn't hear anything. National news did not cover this because they just rolled up their sleeves and they took care of the business that they needed to take care of. They didn't make it a national disaster. They didn't make it a news item for all to see. They just said, hey, you know what? We got the resources. We got the wherewithal. We've got the attitude, and we're going to take care of things the way we're going to take care of things. That's the way subsidiarity works. And they did it without necessarily saying we need to break away and be our own state, our own independent government, without any reliance on the federal connection. There wasn't that at all. So there is a both hand, right? You don't have to think that, well, this concept of localism, this concept of community connectedness has to go to an extreme of, well, and now we need to be our own city-state, which, again, those in London have obvious, fierce loyalty to where they are. We would not have had the Brexit vote success if that wasn't the case. But where do you stop, right? There's got to be some point at which you say, okay, we've probably done enough. Now we got to have some sort of connectedness, or let's just make our house states, right? Own government of our home. All we have time for this afternoon. Thanks for joining me. Thanks for hanging out. I'm Leo Brown, Leo Brown Almost Hour. God bless you.